Well, good afternoon. How are you? Was your week very good? So-so? A little cooler? A little nicer? So, I do have an announcement. Mr. Holliday sent me a note. He said, a member is in need of a ride to Galveston for the feast. If you can accommodate that, please see Mark Holliday after church. So, if you could do that, that would be helpful. And again, it is good to see all your faces as I look around. Some more relaxed than others. Welcome to our visitors as well. If you're here for the first time, I'm glad you're here. Or if you're a visitor who drops in every now and then, thank you for coming. And of course, the routine members, thank you for your being here as well. We are going to continue in the book of Romans, in Romans 7, verses 7 through 12. And the title of the message is The Law Vindicated, Relationships Unmasked. The Law Vindicated, Relationships Unmasked. So let's begin by reading this passage, Romans chapter 7, verses 7 through 12. What shall we say then? Is the law sin? Certainly not. On the contrary, I would not have known sin except through the law. For I would not have known covetousness unless the law had said, you shall not covet. But sin, taking opportunity by the commandment, produced in me all manner of evil desire. For apart from the law, sin was dead. I was alive once without the law, but when the commandment came, sin revived, and I died. And the commandment, which was to bring life, I found to bring death. For sin, taking occasion by the commandment, deceived me, and by it killed me. Therefore, the law is holy, and the commandment holy, and just, and good. Now, you'll recall in the previous message that we talked about the three illustrations that Paul had given in chapter 6 and then the first few verses of chapter 7. And we, in particular, focused on the last illustration, which he gives in chapter 7, verses 1 through 6. And in those three illustrations, the first one was more of baptism and dying and being raised from the dead. The second illustration was the slave-master relationship. You're going to be someone's slave. You're going to be someone's slave. And then the third one was the marriage relationship. Now, do you remember what he said in that illustration? Now, what I want you to do is, for this first part, I want you to listen as if you are an antagonist in a defensive posture of what's being said, what Paul has written, what Paul has said, because you wouldn't be the first one to take that position. So, listen with the ears of an objector, a defensive posture. Now, let me show you in Acts chapter 21, verses 27 and 28, because here's Paul. He's going to the temple with four men for purification rites to counter the belief that he was against the law. And he goes, and here's what it says. Now, when the 7 days were almost ended, the Jews from Asia, seeing him in the temple, the Jews from Asia, they're all at the temple, and they spot him. They see Paul. They see him, and they stirred up the whole crowd. They laid hands on him, crying out, "Men of Israel, help! Help us! This is the man who teaches all men everywhere against the people, that's the Jewish people, against the law and this place. And furthermore, he's also brought Greeks into the temple and has defiled this holy place. Now, that is the air that is being breathed in the first century around Paul, especially from the Jewish sector. That's how they feel about him. That's what the milieu, the atmosphere is. This is the man who is against the people, the law, and this place. Now you recall from last time in the illustration that Paul gave in his third illustration, this is what he wrote in chapter 7, verses 4 through 6. He said, "Therefore, my brethren, you also have become dead to the law through the body of Christ." Now again, listen to this with an antagonistic point of view. You're one of these Jews from Asia. Word has probably made it to Rome. And here you're writing, Paul. This is the man that they've been talking about. It's as if someone came into this church and said, they stood in this pulpit and they said, "This church worships demons. This church is against the law. And you're in this church." Do you feel the weight of that? Does that fire you up? Would that make you upset? Probably so. Probably so. Well, listen to it again with the ears of an antagonist. "You've become dead to the law through the body of Christ." I told you he said it. I told you he said it. You're dead to the law. "So that you may be married to another, to him who was raised from the dead, that you bear fruit for God. For when we were in the flesh, the sinful passions which were aroused by the law were at work in our members to bear forth fruit for death." He said it again. You've got the law as a killer, Paul. You're saying the law rouses up sin and it kills us. That's your perspective on the law. It brings death. In verse 6 he says, "But now we've been delivered from the law." That's right. I hear you. You're saying we got to be delivered from this law, this killer, this murderer. "Having died to what we were held by, it imprisoned us." Yes, that's what you think, Paul. "So that we should serve in the newness of the Spirit and not in the oldness of the letter." There you go. The oldness of the letter. We've got to get rid of that old law, that old letter. Do you hear? Do you understand what he's up against? You've just read that, and maybe you were starting to say, "Okay, Paul, you had me in chapter 6. You had me when you said, 'Do not let sin reign in your mortal bodies.' You had me there. But then you say this. You say this. And furthermore, now everything you've said, I'm going to call into question. Everything you've said from the very beginning of this letter to the very end. Because I've got good friends, Jews from Asia, who corroborate what I'm starting to think. I read in chapter 2, verse 12, what you said, 'For many have sinned without the law, will perish without the law.' You don't need the law, Paul. You're going to die anyway. Why have a law? Or chapter 2, verse 14. 'For when Gentiles, who do not have the law, by nature do the things of the law. These, although not having the law, are law unto themselves. Who needs a law when you can be a law unto yourself? Or 2:17, indeed you're called a Jew who rest on the law, and we do, we Jews, we rest on the law. And you boast in God. There you are, Paul, attacking the law again. Or 2:28, he's not a Jew who is one outwardly, nor is circumcision which is outward in the flesh, but he's a Jew who's one inwardly. You've done it again. You are attacking these people. You're saying our Jewishness, our ethnicity, doesn't mean a thing. And circumcision, it doesn't mean a thing. Or 3:21, but now the righteousness of God apart from the law is revealed. Now I understand, Paul. You are saying the law is gone. And you don't need it. Or 3:28. Therefore we conclude that a man is justified by faith apart from the deeds of the law. Or 4:15. Because the law brings wrath. Paul. This is the law of God. The good law of God. And you're saying it brings wrath. Chapter 5, verse 6. When we were still without strength, in due time, Christ died for the ungodly. Yeah, you've mitigated the law and law keeping. Because you've said everybody sinned. So what does it matter if you keep the law or not? If everybody sinned. And then 5 verse 20, the law entered that the offense might abound. You're saying the very law of God increased offenses. Whereas the Jewish understanding of the day was that God put the law around as a hedge to mitigate unrighteousness. And Paul's saying the law increased it. You say all have sinned. You say we're freely justified by grace apart from the law. And there is no condemnation in those in Jesus Christ. So why not sin? And now you say, in chapter 7, verses 4 through 6, you've become dead to the law through the body of Christ. Verse 5, when we were in the flesh, the sinful passions were aroused by the law at work in our members to bear fruit for death. And verse 6, but now we've been delivered from the law, having died to that which we were held by, so that we should serve in the newness of the Spirit and not in the oldness of the letter. Paul, you've made the law a killer. You've made the law a murderer. You've made the law something that increases wrath. And you've made the law to be the problem. It fans the flames of our desires, and the law is at fault. And therefore, you must believe the law is evil. You must believe the law is evil. And your theology teaches that we need to be delivered from this old sinful letter of the law. Now, Paul knows this. Paul knows the atmosphere of the first century. He understands clearly what people think about him. Very clearly. And so he's going to write these verses, 7 through 12, knowing this, and he has two purposes in mind. two main purposes. The first purpose is to vindicate the law from the charge that it is sinful. That's his purpose. And his second purpose is to disclose the true relationship of sin, law, and death. To disclose the relationship of sin, law, and death. So let's begin our exposition in verse 7. What shall we say then? Is the law sin? Certainly not. Now, this is a rhetorical question. So again, what do we do with rhetorical questions? We change them into a statement, into a first-person singular statement. And the reason why you change it to a first-person singular is because it gives application to yourself. I could just make the statement, but it doesn't give the application to me. So I say, I. How would you change this statement into a statement, this rhetorical question? What shall we say then? Is the law sin? Certainly not. Here's what I wrote. I believe the law certainly is not sin. Now you can restate that in various ways. I certainly believe, I know the law is not sin. Well, Paul, if it's not sin, if the law isn't sin or the cause of sinning, then what's its purpose? What's its purpose? He continues in 7b. On the contrary, I would not have known sin except through the law. So, first of all, this right here, on the contrary, is one word in Greek. It's the word Allah. And it's a contrasting word. We would use it, say, but, however, except. Paul says the law isn't sin, but this right here indicates he's not going to retract anything that he said. All these chapters before, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and parts of 7, he's not going to retract anything. So, the law, he says, I would not have known sin except through the law. So, there's a relationship between sin and law. There's a relationship. It's true the law is not sin, but there's a definitive relationship of law, sin, and death. Now, he first gives a general statement here. I would not have known sin except through the law. That's a general statement. He's going to get more specific because after this, he's going to cite a specific command. So generally, he makes this statement. And then he gets specific with the law inciting covetousness. Now, I would not have known sin except through the law. So what does that tell you? The law defines sin, doesn't it? It defines sin. It gives you the ability to recognize sin. Secondly, the law makes known my sin. The law makes known my sin. Sin, it springs into action. And the law shows that springing. And thirdly, the law reveals my brokenness. Now, you wouldn't know your brokenness. You wouldn't know what sin is. Unless the law said, that is sin. Unless the law spells it out, you have no way of knowing what is sin. So, you could point to 1 John 3:4 if you want another text. Sin is the transgression of what? What? The law. Because you have to transgress the law so that sin appears. It's a breaking of a divine law. Again, Paul's going to get specific now. For, verse 7c, I would not have known covetousness unless the law had said, you shall not covet. That's how I know what coveting is. Because it says, don't do it. So now I look through the Bible and I say, oh, that's coveting. That's coveting. That's coveting. I understand what transgression of the law is in terms of this specific command, do not covet. Now, you shall not covet, it's shorthand. Paul is using shorthand. The rabbis of the time actually did this quite often. Instead of quoting the entire command in Exodus 20, they would say, you shall not covet. And you're expected to know what the rest of the command is. You should not covet anything. Your neighbor's wife, your neighbor's donkey, anything, you shall not covet. Now, this word covet and covetousness, it's the Greek word epithumia. You can look that up in Strong's if you'd like, 1939. It's a neutral word. It simply means desire. It simply means desire. And so the only way to know if it's a good desire or a bad desire is by the context. Now we know Paul, and if you read further down, you know contextually, he's talking about bad desires. And so what he means is truly forbidden desires, unwarranted desires. It's the same word that's used in verse 8 for the desire, forbidden desires. And Paul is saying that he didn't know what it meant to have forbidden desires until the law said, you shall not have unwarranted desires for your neighbor's wife, male servant, female servant, ox, donkey, or anything that is your neighbor's. Rather, those unwarranted, latent, dormant, forbidden desires, they had to be unmasked. That's what the law does. It takes the mask off of those desires and exposes them for what they really are. And he would not have recognized the true nature and the power of sin, both in fact and in experience. Verse 8. But sin, taking opportunity by the commandment, produced in me all manner of evil desire. For apart from the law, sin was dead. And this word, opportunity, is aphorme. And in Mounce's Concise Greek English Dictionary, he says it's a starting point. It means to accomplish an object, an occasion, an opportunity. Again, it's used here in verse 11. You'll see the word occasion, same word. Sin uses then the law. It takes opportunity by the commandment. It uses the commandment as a base of operation, a starting point. It uses it to begin its attack, its work of death. Ken Wust, a scholar, says, This is a starting point or base of operations for an expedition. It was frequently used to denote a base of operations in war. Interesting. A base of operations in war. Paul is saying that the commandment provided sin with a base of operations, an attack upon the soul. It's hard fighting an enemy on their soil, but it's even harder to fight against hidden terrorists in our own country. And such is sin. He is so right. A hidden terrorist in our own country. Look at this. But sin, leave these clauses out, sin produced in me all manner of evil desire. Sin did it. It produced, it worked, it created. Evil, covetousness, desire. And he says, apart from the law, sin was dead. So this sin was in Paul producing, and we'll see in a future message in verse 17 of this same chapter, because this sin that is within Paul, he says in verse 17, but now it is no longer I who do it, but sin that dwells in me. That's why theologians come up with the word indwelling sin. You can call it remaining corruption. It's in us. It's in us. Sin is in us. This enemy sin uses the command of God as a base camp to wage war, and it produces, it results in forbidden desires. And he says, apart from the law, sin was dead. Now, he doesn't mean there was no sin prior to the law coming. He's already told us in chapter 5, verse 13, for until the law, sin was in the world, but sin was not counted when there is no law. So even though there's not a stated law, you still have sin. You still have sin. Because God is eternal. God is eternal. But what he is saying is that sin owes its very existence to the law. It owes its birth to the law. It's through the law that it springs into life. Now here's a question. Why would Paul use coveting as an example? He does have 9 other commands he could use. Why use coveting? An expositor says, the desire for what is forbidden is the first conscious form of sin. That's likely true. You know, when you first awaken in your conscience to that's sin, that's wrong. That's likely true, but I think Paul is getting at something a little more deep here. He's saying he would not have known the full depths and the wretchedness of sin. Now, here are the Ten Commandments. And I want to take this word desire, this word covet, and I want to place it in each one of these. And we're going to say forbidden desires. So commandment one, you shall have no other desires for gods before me. That's massive, isn't it? No desires for any other god? Think that through. There's an ocean beneath that. In everything we do and everything we say, in the material things that we go after. Power, sex, money. You shall have no other desires more than this God. Or number two, you shall not have any desires to make yourselves idols. We live in America, and we know there are idols everywhere. They're everywhere. And if your heart is pulled towards something more than God, that's your idol. You love it. You serve it. Whether it's your career, whether it's your 401k, whether it's your wife or your children, if you love that more than God, you've got your idol. Or number three, you shall not desire to take the name of the Lord your God in vain. Have you ever been speaking with someone and they get you a little upset? The words don't come out, but the word is there. Have you ever done that? That's a forbidden desire. And it happens all the time. Or remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. We'll invert that. Do not have any desires to keep any other day holy. It's forbidden. Do not have any desires to push the Sabbath down and say, you know what, when I was growing up in the church, I couldn't do anything because of the Sabbath. That's a forbidden desire. It's a forbidden desire. It's wrong. I know we feel like that, but it's wrong. Because it doesn't show God the honor that is due Him. Or, my desire is to go out on Friday night, go drink, stay up late, and I wake up the next morning, I'm just too fatigued to go to the Sabbath or go to church or keep the Sabbath. That shows you the desires of your heart. The desires were on your pleasure to do your thing, but you relegate the Sabbath and say, I don't desire God that much. That's a forbidden desire. Or number six. Or five. Do not desire to disobey your father and your mother. That's for you kids. Have you ever had that desire? I'll do it. That's a forbidden desire. Or number six, you shall not desire to murder. Jesus said, if you have hate in your heart towards another, you've murdered, you've killed him. The desires of the heart. Or number seven, you shall not commit adultery. What about when Jesus said, you shall not even look upon a woman to desire her? Where you desire her as if for adultery, or you desire her to a point where it's not a a point of saying, you know, that is a very nice looking woman. That is a very handsome man. No, the desires come up and the brain starts going somewhere else. That is a forbidden desire. Or, you shall not steal. You shall not desire to have something that's not yours. Or, you shall not desire to lie. It's just a little white lie. It preserves my reputation. Everybody does it. You shall not have that desire. And so he comes to number 10, which is really saying, you shall not have forbidden desires. No forbidden desires. Do you see how encompassing the 10th commandment is? The 10th commandment is ultimately one which it wraps around the first, and it says, if you covet something, you're going to satisfy yourself with that rather than God. And so your satisfaction, your joy, your pleasure is in something else but not God. Desires exist, but apart from the 10th commandment, we would likely not make the connection that forbidden desires are sinful as well as forbidden deeds. And therefore, we would not know the power of sin. Unforbidden desires are competitors with the first and great commandment and the second commandment. We sin because our desires are not satisfied in God, and we have to work at the level of desire. I'm going to draw out something here. We have to work at the level of desire. So let's say you have your desires. This is internal. This is inside. This is you. You have your desires, and there is, in this desires, you have indwelling sin, and you have command, which is external. You have external commands. You have the Ten Commandments, and they're coming from the outside. You shall not, you shall not, you shall not, you shall keep, you shall keep. All those are external. Now, with an unconverted person, This is all you get. This is all you get, except these desires. These roots of desire, they form a desire tree. Does that make sense? The desires, they're going to be fulfilled, and they produce this desire tree with its fruit. The fruit of your desires. The fruit of your desires. And Paul says for the unconverted, he talks about the Gentiles. I think it's two P's, is that right? Suppress the one P. Doesn't matter. You suppress. And you only have two ways that you can suppress. You can suppress that way, the command, and say, I don't believe that stuff. I don't believe it. Or you water it down to where it's not, that's not really what it's saying. Or the other is to fulfill these desires outright. Outright. You suppress. You may follow cultural norms and think that's okay, acceptable. But these desires are there, and there are roots of these desires. Now, what happens is this, like I said, you can suppress it or you don't suppress it. And that is, you have the command, and it's external coming, and it says, you shall not do that. This command is hitting your desire path. It's hitting your desire path. My desire says this, and the command comes along like a collision, and you say, but I want. And you either say, no, the command says this, so I will do that. Or your desire path is law. Your desire path is the command. And it supersedes any external command there is. That's all you have to deal with an unconverted person. With a converted person, you have some help because you have this down here. Commands, internal. Because remember Jeremiah 31 and Ezekiel, he's writing it, he's causing you, he's creating in you a new heart and a new mind. He's acting upon you. And so you still have desires. You still have desires, but you've got internal commands and you've got the Spirit of God. The unconverted person doesn't have that. They don't have that. Not in them. Now, God may be wooing you. He may be bringing you to Him, calling, and the Spirit of God working with you, but it's not in you. It's not in you. And so you have these internal commands which were written by God. And so now you still have the same thing. The law of God colliding with your internal desires. But now you have help by the Spirit of God, by the power of God to say, no! You don't have to give in to sin. I don't have to give in to sin. I do way too often. And if you're honest, you would say the same thing. I mean, I just gave you a litany of the commands, verses 1 through 10, each of the commands. And if you fully understand what I said about your desires and forbidden desires, you're probably sitting there going, that's me. That's me. And so the battle, folks, is at the level of desire. It's not out here, primarily. It's primarily in here. If you battle with the external, you may show others that you've made progress. You may make some progress, but you haven't killed the desires. And you may have a desire tree that you come and you take this tree and there's a couple of good fruits on it, and that's the only fruit you show. It's the only fruit you show. Because you don't want people to see. You don't want people to know. the real you, the desires of your heart. And so you show a couple of good fruit. And God doesn't see it that way. God doesn't see it that way. The Spirit of God is not simply editing your heart, it's changing it. He's not taking out a word here or there. He's changing. He's transforming. He's making it new. Everything. Everything is new. Go back to where we were here. And again, that's why we don't work at the behavioral level to conquer sin. If you work primarily at the state of behavior rather than the state of being, your sin will never be conquered. Do we understand that? If you work at the level of behavior rather than the state of my being and my desires, there will be no success with sin. It will master you. Mr. Whitlark wrote in his Friday night message, he said, in regards to weeds, he says, this principle is so important. Pull up the weeds by the roots, because nothing short of that will truly be successful over the long run. I typically watered the garden ahead of time and used a forked weed puller to dig deep enough to reach the roots of the weed. In contrast, if I didn't soften the soil and use just my bare hands, the top part of the plant would almost break away at about ground level. But the root remained firmly planted in the ground, sure to come back, probably stronger than ever. If you don't get the weed by the root, you are essentially just pruning the weed, which probably hurts it more than it hurts. Helps it more than it hurts. He continues, in a similar way, spiritual weeds can be deeply rooted, and it will require the proper or the right technique to rid them from our lives. It doesn't do much good to simply remove the effects, the outward actions. That doesn't do much good at all. It makes you civil. It doesn't do much good to simply remove the effects or outward actions or audible words that can be seen and heard. Instead, we need to dig deeper in order to get to the root cause, our inward thoughts and motivations. No, the law isn't sin, but it's the base of operations for sin to accomplish its evil purpose. It's a paradox, isn't it? What a paradox. Sin produces through the law what the law is against. It's a paradox. What the law is against, sin uses to produce what the law is against. Verse 9. Paul says, I was alive once without the law, but when the commandment came, sin revived and I died. So, you could have two categories: without law and with law. He's saying, when I was without the law, I was alive. I was alive. But when the law came, sin revived, I died. When the law came, I died. Sin sprang to life. It had its origin, its birth, its seminal moment in time when the law came. Now, when was this for Paul? When was he alive without the law and then it came? I don't really know. Could this be when he was a young person and the very first conscious understanding of sin and he understood? I don't know. Could it be when he was 13, went through a bar mitzvah? Could have been. Could it have been when he was on the road to Damascus and he was struck down and he finally saw the depths, sin for what it really is? Could have been. I don't know if it's important that we can define it. It's not, I don't believe. It doesn't bear on any weight of this. It's just to show that without the law, you can feel, you can seem like you're alive. But when the law comes, death comes. Verse 10. And the commandment, which was to bring life, I found brought death. So you remember the commandments in Deuteronomy, I think it's Deuteronomy and Leviticus. It talks about if you do them, you shall live. You'll live if you do these. He's saying, I found the very commandment of God to kill me. Leviticus 18:5, Deuteronomy 5:33, Romans 10, verse 5. The law wasn't meant for salvation, but it did come with promises for a life of obedience. In fact, the law itself was designed to fail, the first covenant. It was designed to fail. That may shock you. But trace it back, go all the way back, and you have the lamb slain from the foundation of the world. And someone might say, well, that could be at the beginning of creation of Adam and Eve, so therefore, maybe not. Okay? What about another text? Before time began, he was slain. What do you do with that one? God knew well in advance what would happen. God knew well in advance sin would emerge. God knew well in advance the covenant would be broken. God knew well in advance the very law that he gave would wind up bringing death. And everybody would be shut up under sin. He knew that. And rather than driving people back to the law for spiritual life, I said spiritual life, apart from the Spirit, it should have driven them to see the mass amount of this forbidden desire in our hearts, in our minds, in the depths of our beings. And you say, oh no, oh no, oh no, that's me. And it should have driven them to repentance, to Christ. It should have. It should have. And the law becomes self-defeating. Verse 11. For sin, taking occasion by the commandment, deceived me, and by it killed me. I wrote out an illustration this morning. I'd prepared this message, but I wrote this out this morning to kind of give you an idea of how Paul is thinking. A two-edged sword has two sharp edges. That's why it's called a two-edged sword. And it cuts in both directions. So whenever you turn it, it cuts. When you pull it this way, it cuts. It's a two-edged sword. And in the hands of an accomplished swordsman, it can do a lot of damage. A lot of damage. Because every movement cuts. Get the picture. Here's God. He appears as if he has a two-edged sword in his hand. He's holding it. It's like a two-edged sword. It's not a two-edged sword. It's much sharper. Much, much sharper than a two-edged sword. And he's holding this, what should be for healing, for correction, for your benefit. He's holding this. And sin comes along, and you're in the room too. You're there. Sin comes along, and it says, well, why do you trust him? Why do you trust that physician who has that sharp two-edged scalpel in his hand? He's like a spy. He's infiltrated. And you know what spies do? What's their purpose? One of their purposes is to get information. And another purpose is to overthrow you. And sin's objective is just that. It's to overthrow you. It's to cause your death, not your life. Whereas the great physician is there wanting life for you. Wanting life. He gains this spy over time. Gains your trust. He plants false information. And he leads you down a wrong path so he can reach his objective. And in time, you come to trust the spy more than God. And you don't like that tool in his hands. You no longer trust the physician. And at that moment, sin leaps to its feet, runs over, grabs the two-edged scalpel, and brings it to you. And says, I've got it for you. It's for you. And you smile. You smile. And he gives you a hug. And he gives you a kiss. And he takes the scalpel and cuts you with 1,000 cuts. And he kills you. That's what sin does to the law of God. It takes that scalpel, it takes that law, and it bludgeons you with it. It kills you with it. Sin uses the commandment of God. It stokes your desires such that the law of God crosses your desire path. And Paul says he found the law to be an instrument of death. Notice where sin gains its power. Paul says in the book of Corinthians, chapter 15, verse 56, the sting of death is sin. Where does it get its power, its strength? The strength, the power of sin is the law. It doesn't have a birth. It doesn't live. It doesn't come to fruition unless there's law. There is God. There is law, which he has given, divine law. And there is sin. The breaking of that divine law. And ultimately, the breaking of law is not an assault upon law. It's an assault upon the one who gave the law. God himself. God himself. Eliot's commentary says, death is pictured as a monster, and it's armed with a sting. Its sting is sin. If there were no sin, death would not be capable of inflicting pain. And the strength of sin springs from the fact that it's a violation of God's law. And so death, personified as a living being, it stings with the poison of sin. It uses the law as a weapon. The law is its instrument. It's an instrument. Now, I don't know if you noticed the prepositions in this text, but there are three prepositions in this passage. And one of them is in verse 7. It says, through the law, same Greek word every time, through the law, by the commandment, or through the commandment, or through the commandment. He says it three times. There's another section he says that later on. But it's through it. It's through it. It's through it. It's by means of the command that sin has its power. Otherwise, sin has no power. We could give you the example of Adam and Eve, where God gave a law. Don't eat that. And Satan comes along and says, looks pretty good to me. And then what does it say? She desired it. She desired it. That's where you have to lop it off. That's where you have to kill it. At the level of desire. She desired this to make her wise. She desired the taste. She desired to see it and look at it because it was quite nice. Because she didn't fight it at the level of desire, she wound up sinning. In fact, you could say she sinned prior to eating because she had a forbidden desire. God had said, don't do it, and she desired it. And so Adam and Eve died. The very objective was reached. Of sin. Let me summarize what we've said today and what Paul has said. He said the law certainly is not sin. The law reveals sin. Sin, however, uses the law of God as a base of operations to wage war. It's not sin, but there's a relationship here that he's not going to renege on what he said and retract it. There is a relationship. And I'm not going to take back anything I've said. Sin uses the law of God as a base of operations to wage war. Fourthly, sin wages war by arousing forbidden desires. Fifthly, the law of God, if perfectly obeyed, would produce life. It would. And God would have given life to Adam and Eve. But no one, every mouth is stopped and shut up under the law of God. And sixthly, sin deceives through the law of God to produce death. It deceives you, and it's a terrible deceiver. It sows distrust. It sows discord. It sows desires. And you think these desires I'm having right now, these feelings, these emotions, and it corroborates my experience. So the law can't be right. My desires are my law. and therefore I obey them. Everybody has these desires, right? Everybody. It's not that bad. Oh, sin is a great deceiver. And it's going to deceive until it kills. That's its objective. Every time. Every single time. Every single time. Well, Paul has proven that the law is innocent. That was one of his objectives. He had to vindicate the law. The law is innocent. It's not the law that's the problem. Sin is. Sin is. So, as you conclude, Paul, is the law sin? No, it's not. Because he says now in verse 12, as he concludes, therefore, I've talked about the law, I vindicate the law, I talked about the relationship of the law and sin and death, and I'm not giving up an inch in what I've said. The law is holy, and the commandment is holy and just and good. Now you see how he's broken this up. He's done the same thing he did in the previous verses. He's gone from general to specific. The law is holy. So if you had this, and this was the law, he would say, that whole body of law is holy. But he's been talking about covetousness. You shall not covet. That's the specific command he's been referencing. And so now he says, and the commandment. Here's the commandment, don't covet. He said, it's holy, it's just, and it's good. Because this is a subset of that, the only thing you can conclude is the entire law of God is holy, just, and good. The whole thing. The whole thing. The law is holy. The law's origin is God. It's holy. He's holy, holy, holy. And it's just. In prescribing what's right and what's wrong, the law cannot be assaulted. The law cannot be said, that's not right. It's just. It's just in what it demands. It's just in what it requires. And it's good. It's good. It's good for you. It's from a good God. Remember Jesus' words where he said, there's only one that's good, God? This comes from a good God. And everything about it is for our good. And so Paul ends by saying the law is holy, just, and good. And this specific commandment of coveting is holy, just, and good, like the whole law. So how would Paul finish? He would say, well, I'm not saying the law is evil. I'm definitely not saying that. But please understand, there is a relationship between sin and the law and death. And he's fulfilled his two purposes. To vindicate the law from the charge that it's sinful. And secondly, to disclose the true relationship of sin, law, and death. Sin is not just a little mistake. It's not just a problem we have. It's huge. It's massive and it's grotesque. Grotesque. It's the deadliest monster you'll ever see or experience or do battle with. And if you're a Christian, you're doing battle with it. Aren't you? I know I do. And sometimes I'll be sitting and thinking and studying, and a thought will come in my mind, and out of the blue, I'll say, "No!" And it actually literally comes out of my mouth. And my kids will hear me at times, "But what's wrong, Dad? I'm engaged in a battle. I'm in a war. I'm in a fight. And it's to the death. And I am not going to let that deceiver, sin, take my life. Take the Spirit of God from me. I'm not going to let it. All he has to offer is death and destruction. That's what he's going to give you. That's why he tries to delude you and entice you and say, come on, come on. But all he has to give you and all he will ever bring you is a dead corpse. Don't fall for it. Don't fall for it, because the law is holy and the commandment is holy and it's just and it's good. And that's where we'll stop today, because it paves the way for the next section and what Paul is going to address. So go out this week. Go out this week and you fight. You fight with the Spirit of God and with the sword of the Spirit. You take it out and you fight with every fiber of your being. Know that it's God in you to will and to do. And you fight at the level of desire.